Today on Fresh Air, we visit with four of the members of Monty Python's Flying Circus: John Cleese, Michael Palin, Eric Idle, and our first guest, Graham Chapman. Chapman, who died in 1989, spoke to Terry 2 years earlier. In Life of Brian, Chapman has the title role as Brian Cohen, the film's reluctant, would-be messiah. In addition to being an inspired comic writer and actor, Chapman was a trained physician and a gay rights activist. Before the interview, let's hear him in a classic Python sketch.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings.
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit. Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert.
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
Oh, I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see. Well, that explains...
Ah, yes. You want room 12A, just along the corridor.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Stupid git.
That was Graham Chapman dishing out the abuse. Terry asked him if his early sketches with Monty Python were considered too risque or eccentric.
Well, the BBC, to begin with, didn't like us very much, which was actually strangely in our favour, because they put us out at a very unpopular hour of the evening, late on a Sunday night, which is not a top slot in Britain. Also, they frequently preempted us with important things like horse show jumping. And they generally didn't rate us very highly, which was good because that meant they didn't even bother to read the scripts. So that meant we could do more or less as we wanted. It wasn't until towards the end of the second series of programmes that they began to realise that we were picking up quite an audience. And then, of course, they began to read the scripts, and that did lead to one or two problems. Naughty words, really. Just silly, childish, naughty words that they would find objectionable, I suppose, because they probably had a problem with their early toilet training, the BBC.
That must be it.
Yes, I think so. Found sensitive areas. But we had then a sort of precedent to point to. We could say, but we said that in programme 3 or whatever, and they would listen to it and found out that we had, and that they had no complaints. And so, you know, we could say, we can say it again then.
I think that there's a lot of British humour and Monty Python-type humour that a lot of Americans don't necessarily get because the language is so different?
Yes, I suppose there are. Although we were quite fortunate in that respect, in that during the whole TV series, we tended not, on the whole, to use topical humour. So that has meant that it is relatively timeless, at least, although there obviously are one or two specific things that that will be pretty meaningless now.
Well, what's your collaborating method when you are working together?
Well, John and I wrote together, Michael Palin and Terry Jones wrote together, Eric wrote on his own, and then Terry Gilliam did all the animations and the visual side of things.
So would you lock yourself up in a room and try to write sketches together?
Yeah, well, John and I would just meet up and sit there for an hour or so, trying to avoid work at all costs, drinking cups of coffee and reading the newspapers, talking about what was in the news, maybe... anything to put off that awful moment of having to put something on paper. And then, about an hour before lunchtime, we'd begin to feel guilty that we hadn't done anything, and at that point we would hopefully think of something which had either occurred during that first hour or so, or if not, then in desperation open up Roger's Thesaurus and simply look at a collection of words to see if that inspired anything, which it sometimes did.
I'll bet it did, because so many of your sketches were wordplay, and it wasn't logical, but it was hysterical.
Look at the cheese shop sketch, for instance.
Oh, and the cheese
almost
dancing.
almost directly from Roger's Thesaurus.
What did you look up that led to that?
Well, we were into cheeses anyway, so we simply looked at that point. We liked the idea of a shop which contained absolutely nothing that it claimed it sold, which is just a minor exaggeration of the way some British shops are. So that was what we were getting at, I think, and decided on cheese as being the comestible in point, and so just looked up a whole list of cheeses in Roger, added a few, and there it was.
Gouda?
No.
Edam?
No.
Caithness?
No.
Smoked Austrian?
No.
Japanese Sage Derby?
No, sir.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Of course, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir. We got...
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
Wensleydale?
Yes?
Ah, well, I'll have some of that.
Oh, I thought you were talking to me, sir. Mr. Wensleydale, that's my name.
Greek feta?
Not as such.
Gorgonzola?
No.
Parmesan?
No.
Mozzarella?
No.
Pepper crema?
No.
Danish
pizza. When you're a comic writer and you're writing with a collaborator, do you laugh at each other's funny lines?
Yes, and also laugh together, too. I mean, there's one whole sketch when John and I, we perhaps had gone a bit too far, but we felt guilty about it while we were writing it, which made us laugh hysterically. And that was the Undertaker's sketch. I mean, perhaps we had gone too far. You know, people taking their dead mothers into Undertakers in a sack, you know, it's on sort of tricky ground, isn't it?
And then they had to decide if they were going to burn them,
bury them,
or dump them.
Right. Yes. That made us feel guilty, I suppose, because all the time we were thinking of our own dear mothers, and it is a bit far to go, isn't it?
Well, this is a real serious issue, I think. If you're writing humor like that, do you want your mother to hear it?
No, you don't. Fortunately, with John and I, we did frequently, I suppose, really think of our own mothers when we were writing sketches. John always used the excuse that it was my mother, and I always used the excuse that it was his. And they seemed to believe that quite satisfactorily.
Graham Chapman, speaking with Terry Gross in 1987, 2 years before his death. He has the title role in Monty Python's Life of Brian, re-released now in theaters and on DVD. Of all the Monty Python players, John Cleese arguably is the most famous. He has the most successful non-Python comedy film in A Fish Called Wanda. He's part of the James Bond franchise now, playing Q, the exasperated weapons specialist who gives new gadgets to the new 007. And on TV, he starred in and co-wrote one of the classic comedies of all time, Fawlty Towers. When Terry spoke to Cleese in 1990, it wasn't comedy that had brought him to town. It was a family therapy conference where he led a seminar with his former therapist, Robin Skinner.
Now, so much of your humor has to do with, kind of skewering a certain businessman mentality or civil service mentality. Now, your father was an insurance salesman,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder if you got some of what those people were like from watching your father and his...
Oh, yes,
business
I'm
associates.
Sure that's right. And I think if somebody had to say, what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable, lower middle class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie finally sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work, comedians, often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face to really, you know, sound off, and they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Well, wait, can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In?
No language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Cards and the Tempertonies. Yeah, well, they glupose and overcall at the Murga chooses. There's to be looking across the bottom, part of Isaac Cruz together, the mid slever, the underpedity, and fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slow perfection. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're...
The first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is... when I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yes, you take the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958, and I've never forgotten it. It got me into the Footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I used the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tick, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I used my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life mm-hmm. or into a parody of that.
Through writing and acting. Yeah, when I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the City of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. So, and if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Tim Brooke Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, I think you're a solicitor. I think killing yourself's quite a cheerful prospect.
Well, he's grinning.
Now, your mother was an acrobat? Is that, this happens to me all
I'm
the
sorry,
time.
I'm getting fed up sometimes. People said BBs.
No, you know, I always, like, very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing, and there's usually, like, one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then, of course, it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was staid-ish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
John Cleese, speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Monty Python's Life of Brian is back in theaters 25 years after it was first shown. We'll continue our tribute to the Pythons after this break.